This is Phantom Electric Ghost, and we're live on the air for the first time with Shannon Sauer Savala. Welcome to the Phantom Electric Ghost podcast. How are you doing tonight or this morning?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you. I want to let people know we are a featured podcast on the Newsly platform. You can see that icon up there. It says listen on Newsly. And for those of you who haven't tried that, you can use the coupon code of Ghost and try that for 1 month free. We are, again, a featured podcast on that platform. If you use coupon code Ghost, you can check that out today. Later today, we'll be on Newsly. We're actually at episode 1050 with this episode. It's tracking that on Apple Podcasts since 2016. And we do have your link here that will be fully clickable, the bpdcompass.com/general-8. That will be clickable, so you don't have to worry about remembering that, but it will be up. And then today we're going to focus on how to nudge your personality to achieve goals and improve your mental health. So again, welcome to the Phantom Electric Ghost podcast. And hope everybody is having a good morning. So one of the first things we like to ask our guest is why do you do what you do? And what motivates you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the reasons I was really excited to come on this podcast was the fact that you interview creative people. And I think that, you know, in my profession as a clinical psychologist and like really academic researcher, right? Like it's not particularly creative and the writing I do is really academic. But when I was deciding whether or not to go to graduate school for clinical psychology, I was also considering going to graduate school for an MFA in creative writing. And so I do sort of see myself as sort of a creative in an academic landscape. And over the past, I don't know, maybe 10 years or so, I've been focused on writing treatment workbooks for patients. And of course, like that's much more creative. It's much more personable with examples and really written for a lay audience. And so I kind of think about treatment development as this really nice intersection of like science and academics and also the ability to be creative. So I was really excited to come and talk a little bit about that. And yeah, as you mentioned, here recently, my research and my clinical work has been focused on helping people nudge their personality traits to improve their mental health. And one of the reasons I'm really passionate about that is because I think there's a lot of misconceptions about personality, right? That you're born with your personality, that it can't be changed. But personality, by definition, is like kind of a summary label that describes your typical way of thinking and behaving. And like, we change how we think about things and we change how we behave all the time. And so if we change those things and we maintain those changes over time, then we've changed our personalities. And there's such a robust research literature on the mental health risks associated with certain personality traits. It's really worth people considering that you could sort of shift those risk factors so that you're kind of in better shape generally. And then the last thing I'll add is that like I see personality change in my own life, right? Like I am a formerly lazy person, formerly really shy. And, you know, now I am kind of an inbox zero sort of person. I have a monogrammed planner and, you know, I get up in front of hundreds of people and do public speaking. So that's like me kind of rambling on about all the reasons I'm passionate about what I do.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking to a lot of different people over time and we started to include therapists and life coaches and people who talk about people's wellness. And what I found is like, you know, people can kind of remap their brains, you know, because if you can find out, like you might've been grown up with like limiting beliefs and you think that's like a truth, but because somebody told you, you weren't good enough. And so you kept on thinking that you couldn't do something. And then finally you have some kind of catalyst and you realize, well, that's not the truth, you know, and you don't have to be confined by these kind of like your own glass ceiling. And, you know, I think a lot of times creative people, they run into traps where they're into like comparison trap. They're into like, I'm not good enough. They have a lot of limiting beliefs, even though they'll be on stages and they seem outwardly like very, you know, they seem like they belong there, but mm-hmm. a lot of times they don't believe they belong there.
Right.
And so like when you're working with an artist, like as a producer, you find a lot of times there's like, wow, this person is not what their mask makes them appear to be.
Yeah, fair enough. Mm-hmm.
So they, like, it's kind of like something you find. And as I think everybody has like their own limitations in terms of like what they're comfortable with. Mm-hmm. And then you realize like you can't be perfect, and you're never, you know, going to get to like 0 to 100. It's like, it's something that's incremental. But I think a lot of times we have such a fast food type of mentality.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants to like 12 steps, 18 steps, like the answer. I'm going to go right to 0 to 100. And so when you're dealing with people like with that kind of situation today, where everybody's, you know, being influenced by these influencers, and they're like AI generated, they're kind of fake, and they think that's right. The paradigm, and they don't realize like, you know, your actual personality with all of its so-called imperfections is like, really, it's like, that's you, and that's like, there's nobody else like that. So you should kind of not be putting yourself down as much as people do.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And you kind of mentioned, like, you know, in your sort of a theme of talking to therapists or coaches, that sometimes there's this catalyst for a big change. And that can be true, right? Like life events are sort of a really important kind of jumpstart for important change. But I also think that like the catalyst can be you, right? And so one of the things that I like to work on with people is this kind of notion of, instead of taking a personality test and staying in your lane, right? Like, I mean, lots of us have taken personality tests probably in high school that told us you'd be a great dentist, or, you know, taken personality tests that like, you know, you're stubborn and that's the way that you're going to be in your relationship. So you should find somebody that is more flexible. Those are examples of personality tests to kind of like stay in your lane. And I think that we can really do the opposite, right? So we can sort of think about what is our goal, right? Like, what types of relationships do we want to have? What types of career opportunities do we want to have? And then kind of imagine what personality traits would increase the likelihood of success. And then think about taking intentional actions that would nudge your own personality traits over time.
Yeah, because that idea of nudging is interesting to me, because I think a lot of times, like, people are given this kind of roadmap, like, oh, you know, you got to go to college, you got to get a career, you got to be in a box. And being a creative person, what we tend to do is, you think about the bell curve, we're on the both sides of that curve.
Right.
And a lot of times, like, you know, in the corporate world, you know, they say they want a creative person, but they tend to want the people that are in the middle of that bell curve that stay in the cubicle. Mm-hmm. And then they wonder why they don't get the creative. Like, you know, because Einstein was getting D's. So
right.
If you measured him, the measurement wasn't correctly assessing who he was. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times with artists, like SATs and tests, they don't measure their capability of artists or creatives. And so the world has these measures that don't actually apply to certain types of people.
Right.
And then those types of people are discouraged from doing it, because that's foo-foo, that's not realistic, you need to have a solid career. So right. It's kind of hard from the start to be authentic, because they want you to like be non-authentic.
Right. Yeah, 100%, right? And then, you know, thinking about like, you know, you're not extroverted, so you would never be able to promote your work. So like, why try, you know? Or you are maybe higher in neuroticism, which is our personality trait that indicates the tendency to experience negative emotions in response to stress. So maybe you get really anxious when you are faced with a deadline, or you have to get up in front of people and really sell your work, right? Or promote. And I think like when we take these personality tests and we sort of assume, when you hear the word personality, that that's static, that right, you're totally right, that could help us. I mean, that could puts us in our own head, so that we, you know, that we're like, well, you know, why bother? And I do think that people are inclined to take the path of least resistance, right? And so change is really hard, right? Like to be less anxious getting up and promoting yourself, to become more extroverted, at least in the situations where you need to bring it on. Like that's pushing you outside of your comfort zone, and that's challenging. And so I think like there's comfort in getting this label and kind of using it to explain why you shouldn't try. But that's not really like backed by science. Science says that our personality traits can and do change over time, and that we can speed the process up by taking these intentional actions.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because a lot of times it's like if you have people who are neurodivergent, and then they're kind of told like, well, you know, you can't be part of society, because society wants you to kind of be in the office.
Right.
But during COVID, people were able to get, you know, a lot of neurodivergent people were able to like kind of shine, because like, oh, I can do this online and I can, but now they're like being forced to like, oh, you got to go back to work.
Right.
Well, you know, I'm able to do it. We were shown that I could do it. Right. So why do I have to fit in the box? Because some CEO says I got to fit in the box. And it's kind of counterintuitive, because they're saying they want these type of people, but then they don't encourage those type of people, or they put roadblocks up for people who are like in the American Disabilities Act and they don't want to pay attention to it, right? They don't want to, it's like, oh no, everybody's got to be in the queue. Everybody's got to have this criteria. And so it seems like very contradictory, you know, in society, because they're building these norms and then people don't fit the norm, and they're saying, well, you know, we're inclusive. And then you find out like, well, they're not so inclusive. They're really still have these biases that maybe they don't even know they have these biases.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that that's super true. You know, I think about like, so my husband is a musician and, you know, kind of a designer. He is trained as an architect. And, you know, for a long time, he worked in event design. And, you know, it was sort of like, he's kind of like a cubicle creativity. And I think that, you know, he was actually laid off during COVID. And we've talked a lot about how he probably wouldn't have taken the leap to start his own architectural design business, because, you know, it's just like the, you know, the status quo is just easier to maintain, right? And that with that push, like he kind of had to, he's now living much more in line with his values. And, you know, we can see, I mean, you can see his creativity really blossom, and his like mood and happiness, right? Because that he's doing what he values.
You're more aligned. You get more aligned with what you want. You know, a lot of times people are on a path that people expect them to be on. Like their parents, the society, the corporation, the rules.
Yeah.
And a lot of times it's like, you know, you don't get a lot of progress if you just stay within the lines. And I've always been like a creative person trying to do like, you know, like both side, left side, right side. I'm a musician and I'm a software designer. What I find is a lot of people don't realize, well, that's totally different things. The music has a lot of math in it. Music has tons of mathematical models. I'm a synthesist, so I design sounds from waveforms, and waveforms go through all these processors like oscillators and envelope generators, and it's very it's very logical, but it's very creative, because it's like something you can kind of know what a square wave is going to do, but if you invert it and you run it through filters, it will do different things that maybe you didn't expect. And so it's kind of like what you hear is what you get, and it's kind of this kind of flow state. Throw it at the wall, let the muse kind of not confine you. And sometimes you're willing to go with the happy accident rather than the planned event. And a lot of times creative people, our gut will tell us to go, had a plan, I wrote it on the bars, and then I came up with something that totally deviated from what I wanted, and it was better. And I go with it rather than thinking what I wrote down was better. And I think that's the challenge for a lot of people, is like they want to stay on the plan, even if they're, you know, the moment suggests that maybe you shouldn't stay on plan.
Yeah. I mean, I get that. I think that applies to like academic research, which is definitely more stick to the plan, and there are ways we do things. And I think like, you know, kind of feeling like a creative person at heart, right? I think that that can be a real strength, because it helps to see you know, well, maybe we haven't looked at it this way, or maybe if we do, you know, if we ask participants to do X, Y, and Z, it'll answer the question in a different way. We'll be able to look at the problem from a different perspective.
Yeah. Like in school, I was a sociology political science major. Mm-hmm. And it was all about in political science, how you asked the question when you did the work. And right. You could kind of predict what you're going to get based on how you ask the questions. I had all my professors would say, like, yeah, if I ask the question this way, I'm going to get this type of response. So I can kind of pre kind of level set this and get what I want. But if I'm more open and I think about alternatives or different options, or I kind of think out like all the way to the end, if I ask this, what kind of responses would I get logically? And so if I want to kind of have a real open-minded point of view rather than narrow point of view, I'm gonna ask the questions that would tend to get these results, or more open-ended questions, so I get different results.
Right.
And so a lot of times people say, "Well, that's the truth." Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on how you kind of massage the truth.
Right. Exactly.
And I think some people just feel things like, well, everything's black and white, and a lot of times there's a lot of gray. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that are kind of like not in the lane. Like, you know, as a musician, we play with genres, right? Mm-hmm. So I could mix jazz with punk,
right?
So I have a punk aesthetic, which is more raw, with a jazz kind of discipline to be, you know, somebody that actually knows the scales, they know the rules.
Right,
but
right.
If they have the punk aesthetic, they're going to mix both and you get something different.
Yeah.
And so it's just a different mindset, you know?
Yeah, it makes me think about, like, you know, Picasso and abstract art, right? Where it's like you kind of have to know the rules to break them. And it's sort of the synthesis in the middle that is like where real creativity or real action happens. And I think that the same, you know, when you mentioned, like, you know, kind of the gray, right, instead of the black and the white, that made me think about, you know, something that comes up in therapy all the time. I'm constantly challenging my clients to think about the gray, to live in the gray, which is super uncomfortable because it's so much easier to tell yourself, you know, that person is a jerk, right? Like, then to kind of accept that or kind of consider in the gray that it sort of takes two, you know, it takes two to tango. Or, you know, and people that I treat really oscillate between it's the other person's entire fault or, oh my gosh, I'm terrible. And really it's kind of in the middle, right? And so when we think about like intentional personality change, yeah, like I think people are like, well, I'm introverted or I'm extroverted, right? And it's like, well,
there's no middle. There's a little bit of everything.
Or it can be situation to situation, right? Like you may be the type of person that likes or needs their quiet time or alone time to sort of recharge, but you might be able to, even if you haven't done it before, you might be able to, if you push yourself, learn to turn on that particular trait in situations that warrant it. And thinking about artists, right? You have to be able to promote if you're wanting like that kind of exposure or recognition, right? I mean, I talk about this with my husband all the time because he's a musician, and sort of the like, if a song is recorded in a forest and no one's around to hear it, like, is still the process enjoyable? And kind of going back and forth of like, he's really driven to create this music, and like, you know, he wants people to listen to it.
Yeah, it's kind of like the creative drive. There's a point in time where you're at, like, you're in your lab. I'm in my bedroom studio around all my synths. Like a lot of artists was like, well, I want to stay in this womb kind of bedroom, you know, producers, my studio. But there's a point where you got to bring that out of the studio to the public. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times it depends on whether you're a good marketer. If you think about a guy like William Blake, one of the great romantic poets, he wasn't a very good marketer. Nobody knew him during a romantic period. But he took his art, his poems, and he etched them in acid on metal plates. And so they were found after he was gone. So he had the kind of forethought, I'm not just going to put these on paper. I'm going to put these and etch, make them like eternal. So he wasn't the greatest marketer in his time. But because he went and did that, he became one of the greatest romantic poets, but he wasn't known in his time.
Right.
So it's still like the, you want to bring a little bit of that to the present, right? Like you have to promote. Like he thought about like this idea, we'll put them in metal, and they were found, but they weren't found in his time.
Right.
So that, you know, so that's the you do have to put time into your like promotion, or nobody's gonna know you.
Exactly. Yeah, I think another personality trait that's probably relevant for creatives, and may be something that like creatives maybe, I mean, this is a generalization, obviously, but don't think of as like their vein is sort of like conscientiousness and planfulness, right? Because you know, the biggest predictor of success in one's kind of chosen path is how diligent and conscientious you are, how able you are to persevere in the face of setbacks. And that's the personality trait of conscientiousness, you know, kind of on a continuum with disinhibition, right? Where it's like, I'm kind of just like, stuff happens and I'm kind of pulled in different directions. And conscientiousness is actually one of the easier personality traits to change. I mean, I can think about, you know, like I said, like I'm formerly lazy person and now am like successful academic. And, you know, when I was younger, I sort of had these beliefs that what I did really didn't matter. And I think some of that is based on, you know, being kind of a first generation college student, being like not coming from a family with a lot of money, kind of thinking like, I don't know, like didn't really necessarily have big dreams, and how I had this like little moment, like I can't actually pinpoint a, you know, like a big, like earth-shaking moment that shifted my personality. It wasn't like a lightning strike, but it was like a ton of little changes over time, right? So when I was in my freshman year of college, and like meanwhile I'm like mostly I'm skipping a lot of my classes and just sleeping in and kind of just flitting around, but I found psychology really interesting and like made it to that class, and we took these tests, you know, sort of like every couple of weeks, multiple choice tests. And most people did really not well on them. They were like famous for being really hard. And I did well. And I remember the TA, like going to pick up my test score. You had to like go check in with the TA. The TA saying like, you know, you should really consider majoring in psychology. And like, that moment, I was like, yeah, okay. Yeah, and I started to see myself as somebody that was good at psychology, right? You know, so I still wasn't necessarily performing very well in my other classes, but I, you know, if I was a psychology class, I was going, I was studying really hard, I was making flashcards, which kind of like ages me. And I, you know, I was performing really well and helping others, you know, studying with others. And so that kind of continued until like maybe the end of my sophomore year. And I, you know, I was like, you know, I think I want to go to graduate school for psychology. I'm good at it. And I really like it. And I really like interacting with people. So like, I think I would be a good therapist. And it became clear based on my overall GPA that I was not going to get into graduate school. And that was really upsetting, right? And so something that can happen, right? Like, when basically, like, I think about, this is another sort of psychology thing, I think about like principles of reinforcement, right? So when something good happens and you get rewarded, it makes the behavior more likely, right? So I was rewarded for studying for that test by what the TA said, and that, you know, I kept getting rewarded, so I kept doing it. Another form of reinforcement that's really important is negative reinforcement. It's like taking away something that feels bad, right? And so it felt bad to kind of get the feedback, yeah, you're not really that competitive for graduate school. I did not want to feel that way. I felt guilty and I felt upset. And, you know, over time, I was able to, you know, I was like, that sort of lit a fire under me. Like, I have to start really performing in my other classes.
Discipline to get the other, to get where you want to go. Like, you want to be a surgeon, but you got to pass biochem. You got to be able to do the chemistry. You got to be able to do the math. You got to be able to. So you might, you know, be really good at certain aspects of it, but you got to build up.
Right.
You know, and it's kind of like, I think it's like athletics. Like, if you first show up and you try and get the 3-point shot, you're not hitting it.
Right.
Until you do it like 1,000 times, then you hit it. Like in the end of that 1,000, like by the time you get to the last, you know, 30% of that, you're probably hitting it all the time.
Right.
It's just that with the beginning, you're not. And I think if you're a musician, right, you practice. Like, first, you don't get the piece. You don't get it. You don't get the skills. Mm-hmm. But if you show up,
right,
if you don't skip, if you actually get involved, you'll start, what was hard becomes like muscle memory.
Right. And so, that's exactly, I think, for creatives, right, that like that idea of practicing and getting really good at your craft, take that template and apply it to like intentional personality change, because it's basically the same thing.
Yeah, that's why I try to, like, a lot of times creatives were kind of put into this, like, oh, you guys are foo-foo. Mm-hmm. You guys are childish. You got a childlike. And like, well, how can you go and have the audacity to do these things? Well, there's a certain level of discipline in the, mm-hmm. Whether you're a painter, an actor, right, a musician, like all the different form photographer, there's a discipline to like learn the aspects of your, and it just is what the same level of stuff that it takes to become a mathematician, a physicist, a scientist, a doctor. It's the same thing.
Right.
And so when you find something that you're good at, whether it's athletics or philosophy or whatever, like the discipline involved is like across the board. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think you can learn lessons from one thing to the next. And everybody always wants to stay in one lane, but mm-hmm. some capabilities can be shared across many lanes. And then you can get to be more of like that, the kind of jack of all trades. Like, you can start to learn. You needed to build up to be able to go to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're going to be an artist, you got to have a stage presence.
Right.
You could be great at playing, but you keep your back to the audience and you have no character.
Right.
No one's going to want to see you. Right. They want to hear you. So maybe you could be a studio mm-hmm. musician. But if your goal is to be the stage musician, then you need to bring a little Lady Gaga, a little Prince, a little Michael Jackson. You got to learn how to, you got to have to amp it up. And a lot of these people, if you looked at them, like Prince was shy, unbelievably shy. Michael Jackson was unbelievably shy. Bowie, before he got into his theatrics, didn't have that stage presence.
Mm-hmm.
So that was learned. That was practiced.
Yeah.
It wasn't just natural. People just think it's like, oh, 0 to 100 just happened. It's like,
it never just happened.
Yeah, it never just happens.
Right.
Usually there's a level of effort that's ignored.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, in terms of we're talking about the nudging, the personality, mm-hmm. you talk about it, it's not always like that crucible catalyst moment. Sometimes it's kind of like if you're on a diet, right? If the fad diet doesn't work, right? What works is something that you're going to do for the next 30 years, the rest of your life. Like, so when you start to learn intentional things that are actually sustainable, then you can actually make progress. Because if it's something that's so hard or something that you're never really going to do, you're only going to, stay in that for whatever length of time that you can kind of manage it. And usually it's not going to last.
Yeah. And I think about that, being able to do things that are manageable that will stick, and being able to do things that are possible right now, right? So like, if I have a goal to be like a keynote speaker and talk in front of a lot of people, but I only have ever communicated my sort of like academic research through journal articles, then, booking a keynote speaking gig in front of thousands of people is like going to be really anxiety provoking. And I mean, probably not logistically possible, but if we imagined that it was, that's going to be really scary. That's a big jump, right? So like, what are small manageable steps that will probably go well and capitalize on those principles of reinforcement, right? So like, how can you do something that is going to get a reward? And the reward can be as simple as just like pride, like I did that. Or it could be, I don't know, I'm trying to be like timely. It could be likes or shares. Kind of thinking about your end of the road goal and then kind of backing it up a little bit and thinking about, well, what can I do today that will push me a little bit, put me outside my comfort zone a little bit, but like I can do it. And then when that gets reinforced, then you think, what's the next thing I can do that will push me a little bit? And that's where I think we get into this idea of like an upward spiral, right? We think about downward spirals. I think people have started to talk about upward spirals a little bit more. And that's that idea that like, you know, it's like a funnel, right? It's narrow at the bottom because you're making tiny changes, but then they build off of each other and, you know, kind of manifest over time.
Yeah. Now how to actually manifest and actually get to like actualize is kind of like you dream it, but you don't just keep it in your head. You start to practice those things. You start to, like, as an artist, if you, I've been around artists, like you got all the paintings in your loft. And then you're, and you have somebody said, well, these are brilliant. It's like, well, you have a gallery show? No, I'm not ready.
Right.
Well, it's like that mindset that you're not ready. It's like, what's the first step for every musician that shows up like in a pizza bar and does the first show there, right? It does it at the you know, the talent show. Well, you got to show up, right? And so it's so you, over time you show up, your lessons learned from your mistakes, right?
Right.
You can't expect, like you said, they're going in front of 1,000 people and not make a mistake, right? You're going to make all artists, you know, we make our mistakes, and in kind of those like in public mistakes, they can be lessons learned. And if you don't
take it, a way to reinforce.
Yeah. If you don't take it as like, that's the end of the world, cause you bombed. Like every comic has a joke that bombs, and it's how they recover from the bomb that keeps them going. It's kind of like that. That riffing, there's like, oh, that bomb, that didn't work, so like adjust it, you know. That's kind of like the talent,
right? It's like that idea of information gathering based on how certain kind of bits performed. And like I think that kind of going back to that personality trait of neuroticism, right? The tendency to experience negative emotions and kind of negative thinking, right? Like, I mean, I think about giving feedback, and, you know, sometimes you can give somebody like 90% positive feedback and then give them one piece of constructive criticism, and they will really just like hone in on that tiny piece, right? And it's a skill, right? It's a personality kind of orientation towards the negative thing or the positive thing. And that too is something that if you made the decision to, you could shift over time to focus more on like, well, it was 90% positive, so I'm feeling actually pretty good about it. And I can work on this other thing, as opposed to like, I am never going to make it.
Yeah. What's the kind of trigger? Learn how to handle your triggers. Cause like, if you're the kind of person, somebody cuts you off, there's a lot of people like you're driving, and like, that's not going to cause road rage. Right? But there's a certain person, if it will cause the road rage.
Right.
And if they start to recognize like that kind of slight is so important to them, that it gets them out of the car, gets them into that kind of things. Like, well, how do you start to realize you have that tendency and learn how to make a different choice, right?
Yeah.
Learn, like, yeah, I shouldn't go from a 0 to 100 and get out the car and want to get into the fight, right? like I start thinking like, well, you know, that's not the biggest slight in the world, right? You know, like, how do you start to like turn that mountain back to a molehill, right? It's like that 1% criticism now has got you red-faced. And you're you're freaking out. And like, how do you start to learn your triggers and start to like come up with a plan on how to like deal?
Yeah. And I think that you're describing therapy skill, right? Which is like, know your triggers, right? Because if you want to make a different choice and change your behavior and change your thinking patterns, right? Like, i.e. change your personality, you have to be aware of what your triggers are that kind of bring out the personality traits that you are trying to change. So, you know, talking about road rage, that's the personality trait of agreeableness versus antagonism, right? And so, you know, people fit along that spectrum, and there's no like right or wrong place to be necessarily. Like, we think being more agreeable is a good thing. And, you know, in general it is, right? Like, we're more likely to have satisfying relationships. However, too far agreeable and you are probably really compliant and really kind of subjugate your own needs so that you can help other people, and that doesn't really work either.
You become like a people pleaser, and then you think like you're always people pleasing, but you're not. It's like not really effective. And you think you're helping people, but you're really not, because if you're subjugating yourself, your own interest, to everybody's interest, you're probably getting resentful.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And you probably have other triggers.
Right.
And if people don't even realize they're going to trigger it because you got this people pleaser thing and you don't really do what you want. And then you have never have time for your own thing because you're doing everybody else's thing.
Right. And it's like adaptive to have like a little touch of the antagonism, because that's how you are like, hey, like when you said that, it wasn't okay. Or when you, did that, it wasn't okay, right? Or here's what I need. And, you know, I think that people that are too far on the agreeable side of things think that like asking for what you need is selfish, right? And then people that are really far on the other side, the antagonism side, are like, this is my road. I can't believe that person cut me off, right? And kind of have that rage is easier, right? And so both could really learn from each other, right? Like kind of meeting somewhere in the middle, and how do you nudge? And so I think you're right, like being aware of your triggers so that like I know, you know, my antagonism shows when I'm cut off in traffic. So I have a plan for how I'm going to try to behave differently. So I do, like I don't start screaming at the person. Maybe I decide that I turn up my radio or I put on a podcast or something. And when nothing bad happens as a function of doing a different behavior, we learn, right? We learn, oh, the anger goes away on its own. I don't have to curse out my window. It just comes down naturally on its own. And then that's reinforcing. So then we might be inclined to behave similarly going forward.
Yeah. If you don't have to win every argument, like, right. You know, that you can learn. Like if your mindset isn't such that like, you're not able to learn because you have these like significant beliefs. Like, so even if somebody gives you something that's like a scientific fact, like you don't believe it because you've been kind of put into this conditioning where like, right. I only believe X, anything other than X is like blasphemy.
Yeah.
Like, so I can't even get out of it. And we see a lot of people today are on such like very tight mindsets that they've been told X and X is the only truth. And there's like no getting out of it.
Right.
You know, you can show them facts and then they don't believe the facts.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a lot.
It could be snowing. They say it's not. So we're like, what is that?
Yeah. So I think like beliefs and behavior change as a function of experience, right? And like data. And so if you haven't been exposed to a ton, or you're sort of like in an echo chamber where like you aren't challenged at all, somebody telling you right over a Thanksgiving dinner table, perhaps that maybe they should consider a different political belief or, you know, anything or something else, that's going to go in one ear and out the other. It's not going to create any change. Right. But we're all, I guess, like kind of individual scientists kind of collecting data on our own lives and our own experiences. And so if you kind of have this sort of hypothesis that the world is one way and you decide that you maybe want to be more open to other ideas, you might engage in a behavior that tests that hypothesis, right? Like if I think I'm trying to think of like a not that controversial thing that I think. If I think that people are going to laugh at me if I give a talk, right? Like, I'm going to keep that. A belief is not going to change, right? Like, you could tell me that that's not going to happen, but like, I won't believe you until I get up there and do it and see for myself, right? I confirm my hypothesis or I disprove it. And so I think like that's where that intentional change comes. I also think, right, and anyone that's ever been in a relationship with anybody knows that you can't make somebody change, right? Like that has to be internal. Like you can't, there has to be that intention or, you know, that desire internally, right? And so I do think that like, you know, kind of going back to the idea that like we get our personality tests and we're like, okay, like I can't do that, so I might as well not try, right? Like, people are comfortable staying in their belief systems because challenging that, you know, pushes a boundary, right? And it's the same thing for like exchange of ideas. So, you know, it's effort to consider that the world is gray and that people that like maybe hold a different political affiliation than me, or people that hold a different religious background than me, that like they might have a point. Like that's that gray is hard to think about. So that you can change, right? But you have to have that intrinsic motivation to do it.
It's also like when you think about society today with people having issues like even communicating, like dating. Like, you know, everybody's using like apps because they don't feel safe. So they want to use an app. They want to have a filter. And so if they actually meet somebody in real life, right, and somebody, they have a connection, and they actually start to feel like, well, I could talk to this person. Then they sound like, wow, like there's a fear. Well, I didn't get this person validated through the app. I didn't get them background check. So I, even though this feeling seems like there's a connection, it's like, I'm going to stay away from it because it's too dangerous. So then there's like this kind of like isolationism we're creating because like, oh, the only correct way is through this validated app or through this conversation. So then we're losing some like communication skills because like we're saying, well, this is the right way. And this other way is too dangerous. And, you know, it could be, but it's like, you know, it's like, how do we make, you know, like judgments that aren't so like absolute?
Yeah. I think that's a really good point. And one of the things, I mean, I actually talk about with my patients about dating a lot because it's something that's really important to a lot of people. And it's something that's really anxiety provoking. So, you know, I definitely hear you around like the filters, right? And the, you know, like the curated dating profile. And you could think about that with any social media, right? Where it's like, maybe it's not a dating profile, but it's like your Instagram or your Facebook. We're not really presenting all of us there. It's a very curated thing. And I mean, that seems fine on the surface, but it, and maybe like in the terms of a dating profile, the curated profile attracts more people at first, but it can actually increase anxiety. It can backfire because they don't know the real you, right? And so it's like, you created this curated thing and then there's like this pressure to keep that up, right? And so I'm always kind of telling people like, you know, you should be yourself because wouldn't you rather find out sooner that you're not compatible? Later. Then, you know, then attract people that you're not compatible with based on your sort of like public persona.
Yeah. With this idealized vision, you know, it's kind of like, are you going to be vulnerable? Like as an artist, we have choices. Like I can clone the top 20 artists and try to match them because I'm a musician and I can figure out how to totally match their rhythm, the sound, whatever, even their affectations. I could totally just clone them.
Yeah.
And get the get the same response on an algorithm, try to mimic so I get the same kind of result. I'm in the same zone. But it's harder to be vulnerable and be my own self and put something out that's initially not going to get the likes, not going to get the views. It's going to speak to something that might not be what's popular.
Right.
But with more authentic and over time, if I keep on presenting that, I'm going to build an audience. It's just going to take longer. It's going to be harder. It's easier to kind of jump the line and just copy or present something that's not authentic. So I think people are scared of like the vulnerability of presenting the actual real artist or real person.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you could take that into sort of like therapy change as well, right? Because expressing a desire to change is a vulnerability, right? Like it's admitting that, you know, maybe some things aren't working and that like, then sort of like puts you in this position where you have to work hard to make some, to make the change. Right. And that, that is, that's a huge vulnerability. You know, I think you kind of mentioned this too, right. That you could, you know, in sort of like the creative sphere, you could sort of like fabricate or authentic, you know, kind of copy or clone, you know, kind of styles of what's popular and that could build, you know, sort of fan base more quickly. And I think that like we do sort of live in a society that isn't particularly patient. And so I think like that's another pressure to do that versus like wanting to be more authentic, to be your vulnerable self, to take the time to connect with the people that like, you know, are like-minded or that appreciate you for you. And at the end of the day, you will feel better about yourself if you're kind of living it all out there and people still like you.
Yeah. Well, because if you show up, you know, on those stages as that authentic self, you think the idea like a Bob Dylan, You know, Bob Dylan initially presented himself as like an Arlo Guthrie, Woody Guthrie clone. He actually sounded like them. Mm-hmm. He had songs that were totally like clone. They were like exactly like that. Then he came up with this nasal kind of his own style. It was totally different than what he had been kind of aping. He was like doing this other thing.
Right.
And then he added electric. And then people said, well, you're a Judas. He's like, he showed up at the jazz festival and he had this electric band. And he had that nasal voice. And he, what's that? And then it became critically acclaimed. The critics started saying, this stuff is like, listen to the lyrics. Mm-hmm. Listen to what he's doing. It's not what had been done. He suddenly became like this amalgamation of everything he had kind of took from the old folk people. But then he mixed a bunch of other things and then he found his voice. And that's what actually hit.
Right.
And initially was like critically, people were yelling at him. Like in England, they were like throwing stuff at him, telling him he's terrible. He's like, but he kept on going into it and perfecting it and getting better. And then eventually the critics, you know, he got allies by sticking to it. And I think that's what's hard, because it's hard to kind of stick to your guns and actually stay authentic when there's a pressure, like to go along, get to get along.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. It's like you said, it's vulnerable and it takes time. And, you know, I think the Bob Dylan example is a really good, I mean, it's just a good example of change is uncomfortable internally, and it's uncomfortable externally too, right? So if you decide like you are going to be a little bit more assertive, right, that's your goal, well, people in your family or your friends who are used to you just always saying yes when they ask you to help them move, there's going to be pushback, right? And so, I mean, that's what happened to Bob Dylan, right? When he got up and played with an electric guitar, and it's kind of a different affectation. People, I mean, I think I've heard the story that he was like booed.
Yeah, he would boo people yelling like Judas.
Yeah.
And then he actually said, it's on tape, I don't believe you. Like Dylan, and he kept on going. And he didn't end the set. You know, some people would just end the set. They were booing really heavy. I've got the audio of it. It's a famous concert. It's actually on, they actually have it released with the boos. And and people yelling and saying they hated it. And there's even a documentary of people saying that he's like the worst musician in the world and they hate him. And they were going off. And he just like he said, I don't believe you, which was like really radical for an artist like on stage to say, I don't believe what you're saying about me. I'm going to keep on going.
Right.
And that to me was like, as an artist, you know, like Lou Reed, he was the kind of guy who did stuff like that too. He just kept on going with what his style was, which basically was spoken word poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And from 66 to 70, nobody liked it. And then he did Walk on the Wild Side, and Bowie kind of gave him some backing, and then boom, suddenly what everybody said was terrible was somehow now the greatest thing in the world.
Right.
But you know, from 66 to 70, he kept that at it. He kept, and nobody liked him except other producers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really kind of like you're living in the, and the problem today is like a lot of times, like, does the world even give you that kind of space that Lou Reed could go from 66 to 70?
Right.
And be supported to be able to continue to 72 to again end up working with Bowie. Mm-hmm. You're wondering, like, I don't know, because people are so into instant gratification and instant satisfaction, they wouldn't even give the time to allow a Lou Reed to happen or a Bob Dylan to happen.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that that's really hard. That's something that I've talked a lot about, like with my husband, just about music, right? And that a lot of, I mean, I feel like I'm pretty stuck in my listening to like late 90s, early 2000s indie rock, because for me, a lot of like the newer stuff sounds the same. And I think it's this phenomenon that you're talking about. It's like this recipe or this formula, and that like people are less willing to take risks because of like all the online streaming. There's so much more like choice, I guess.
Yeah.
And so there isn't, you know, I mean, I remember going to the record store when I was, you know, with like $20 and I could buy one CD, you know, and so it's like, you have to sit with it. Like you make a choice based on one song you heard on the radio, and then you have to sit with it and learn and like it and like evolve with it and grow with it. And that really isn't happening now. I don't think.
Yeah, we also, have this kind of thing in arts where there used to be these radio stations that were independent and the DJs could go pick whatever locally was happening. And so they would go listen to the clubs and find the new acts. But now you've got these kind of corporations making one guy responsible for a whole region. One guy. So one guy gets his their taste, and it's kind of very narrow. It compared to, I saw this documentary where this DJ was like lamenting the reason that the diversity is not there in what we hear is because you don't have, you did have gatekeepers, but you had gatekeepers that could make choices about, I should like Chuck Berry's cool. Little Richard's cool. That this band from Detroit is cool. This Detroit sound is cool. It's like, well, now you're not getting a Detroit sound or a Chicago sound or a Boston sound. It's like it's a whole 50 state strategy because this one guy controls the whole market. And you're like, what? Like, why would you do that? Yeah. But because you know, the bean counter said that's more efficient. But when it comes to the arts, like things aren't efficient. That's the problem. Like, you try to put efficiency into the arts, like then you get like no choice because like it doesn't logically make sense sometimes.
Right.
And that's the thing is like personalities, they think about people is like, we're not always going to fit in the box.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then we might say that the box is the standard bearer is the box. And it's like, well, okay, what are you going to get?
Yeah. And then kind of considering, I think, you know, kind of going back to that example of somebody that's been like pretty agreeable, pretty, you know, like always shows up to help friends move, even at like personal cost to themselves, right? Like that person, that's the box that they're in. And if they make a decision to change that, there's going to be pushback, right? Because the system was working for the other people around them, right? And so being willing to really hone in on what's important to you, what your values are, you know, at the end of the day, how you want to feel about yourself, and making those changes, even if there is, you know, some pushback from the system.
Yeah. Well, I think today, like what you have to do is try to just present without the mask on, which is hard.
Yeah.
Cause like society is always going to have, you have a certain, state, we call it like stage presence. Like if I'm with my family, like that's who they see. If I'm with my boss, that's who they see. If I'm this person, this is what they see. We kind of put on it automatically.
Right.
And maybe we need to get more aware of what we're actually putting on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when you start to do the self-assessment, it's like, well, how I present to my wife is different than how I present to this person, how I present to that person. And you start to like kind of dive into like, why are you doing that? And I don't know if people take the time until they go into therapy as like, why are you presenting this way? You know, is that what you do when you get into therapy? To kind of dive into like, why are you presenting these different versions of yourself?
Yeah, right. I mean, yes. So we all do this to some degree, right? Like the way that you interact with your boss or your professor, like obviously there's going to be differences than how you interact with your partner or with your kids. And that's natural and normal, right? So I think in therapy, what we look at is to see if these kind of changing selves is causing problems for you in the long term. So one of the kind of like disorder groups that I kind of specialize in is called borderline personality disorder. And one of the symptoms of BPD is, being different with different people. And then kind of the second part of that clause is, so you don't really know who the real you is. And so that's an example of like, you know, it's not like a college student changing their major once or twice. It's not, you know, kind of being a little bit more familiar with your wife than you are with your boss, right? It's like really, you know, when I hang out with these people, I have these things. And then I started to hang out with this other group and now I'm going to be vegan. And oh, now I'm with this other group. So I'm going to do something different. So that you don't really know what's important to you and what your values are. And yeah, right. Like, I think that that is, that's something that we really examine. So I usually at the beginning of therapy talk about people's values with them. We have a list of 11 different kind of domains for values. So like what you want to be like as a partner, what you want to be like as like an adult child or brother or sister, what you want to be like as a parent, a friend, like what are your values about career? What are your values about personal growth and so on? And we really spend a lot of time at the beginning, at least, you know, when people work with me, figuring out what's important to the person. And like values are different than goals, right? Like values are sort of life directions. And just like you can't ever arrive at West, you know, you never get there. You never get to like being an honest person. It's not like you're like, oh, I was honest once, like check. It's like the way that you're going. And goals kind of can fit along the value. And so we talk about the difference between values and goals. And then we really spend a lot of time going through each of these domains and, you know, I kind of helping or providing scaffolding for the patient to identify what their values are. And the reason we do that is because I don't want to assume that there's a one size fits all right personality or right way to be or right behaviors, right? It's like what you value and how can we shift your traits? How can we shift your behaviors and your thoughts so that you can get closer to your values?
That's a really important thing because I think there's a lot of people who probably think there is some kind of standard like self. And that's part of the problem. Like everybody's thinking they got to be the standard kind of human being. This is the right human being. Like a human beings have so many different like aspects. Like that's part of your personality is the unique, you know, variation. That's the to me is like, and people try to get away from the variation and think it's not right. But I think it's like that, the kind of learning to like live with it. And like it and love it. I think that's a lot of problems. There's a lot of times people, that's selfish to love myself. Well, if you don't love yourself, there's going to be a lot of things that kind of cascade from that.
Right.
So if you think that's like foo-foo, that I don't need to do that. I just need to find my soulmate and they're going to fix me.
Right.
Like, well, you're probably not going to get fixed because you didn't solve the root cause.
Right. And you're not going to find the right person if you aren't living in accordance with your values, right? Like you got to like get yourself right first. Otherwise, like, I mean, we talk about this a lot in therapy where, you know, if you don't respect yourself, you're going to behave in certain ways that attract people that don't respect you. Right. And like, a prerequisite for being in a healthy relationship is being in a healthy relationship with yourself first.
Yeah, it's like a law of attraction. Like you're gonna keep on getting into codependency if you kind of have that tendency. You're gonna attract codependency until you realize that that's a problem, and it's not gonna get solved by the next person because the next person is probably gonna be the same person you've been running into all the time.
Right.
And it's like there's really like look in the looking glass, like the poets used to focus on the looking glass self. Mm-hmm. And why? Because that's where all the stories are. Like that's where the whole call. I mean, all songwriters kind of get into a looking glass self. That's like where we start. Mm-hmm. And then we look at other things, but it's kind of that dive is our catharsis. And why we write is to dive into that and pull out what we can, you know, and that's what feels authentic when we hit it. And then people hear that chord. They hear like, wow, that's something I feel. Cause we kind of hit the central theme.
Yeah.
That people can understand, and it's kind of that empathy that we try to tap into. We try to tap into these kind of universal concepts. It's like, if I put this out there, I mean, if you're going to interpret it however you do, but you're going to feel something because I'm kind of tapping into that frequency.
Right.
And there's an understanding. And that's the more that it resonates, then we've actually hit it right. That we actually hit the core. And that's what we're trying to do. That's how you actually connect with the audience. You start to understand that.
Yeah. I mean, we actually have an exercise in that we do in therapy where we ask people to pick a personally relevant song that they think will bring up strong emotions for them. And we do kind of a mindfulness exercise where we listen to the song and we just notice everything that's coming up, all the emotions that are coming up. And so, I mean, I think that you make a really good point. And I think like that there is this sort of like relationship between art and, you know, kind of like self-improvement or therapy or personality change, in that it's really validating to kind of hear your sort of inner monologue that maybe you don't show to a lot of people echoed in like such a public way, like in a piece of art. And I think that that gives people some, just some more like confidence to express some of that.
Dive into it. Yeah. Cause a lot of people's favorite song will kind of dive into it, and then maybe they might get into therapy because they're kind of exploring, you know, something that Joni Mitchell said.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. Something you know, Carole King said, you know, like, you know, it's like a tapestry. I was listening to Tapestry, and that echoed something in my own relationship, and then I need to dive into it. And it's kind of like, well, you know, it's like the songwriters are kind of, that's what their goal is, to have that kind of connection. You know, they see that commonality with all human beings. They're going to feel that, whether you're a woman or a man or whatever, you feel these emotions. Mm-hmm. You want to tap into it and get people to say it's okay. It's not foo-foo. They get melancholy or get happy or get, you know, whatever feeling you're going to trigger. That's what we're trying to actually have happen. But I want to thank you again for being on the show. It always goes by quicker than we ever think.
Yeah.
We actually hit the hour. And I do want to remind people they can click on the link below, the bdpcompass.com, and that will be fully clickable. So you won't have to remember about like trying to remember that, but it will be on all the platforms. We're on all the major podcast platforms where you can listen to or watch podcasts. And we will be on there later today. We've been on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitch. And I want to thank you again for being a guest on the Fam Electric Ghost podcast.
Yeah, my absolute pleasure. This has been awesome.
Thank you. Have a great rest of the day.
Thank you.